Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, H.J. Heinz Company, maker of the famous Heinz 57 varieties, presents Information Please, with four experts ready and willing to answer your questions. Mail them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. We may edit them slightly, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment as to the question we use. If we do use it, you'll get, with the compliments of H.J. Heinz Company, $10 in war stamps and the Encyclopedia Britannica World Atlas. If the experts flop on your question, H.J. Heinz Company sends you $57 in war bonds and stamps and a set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And don't forget that if the experts should miss all three parts of your question, you get, in addition to the encyclopedia, a $500 war bond instead of the usual $57. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpaul. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, spontaneous and unrehearsed as usual, Information Please presents tonight our two regulars, John Kieran of the New York Sun and Franklin P. Adams of Western Connecticut, who welcome as their guests two notable men of letters. Our old friend Christopher Morley, whose new book of light verse, The Middle Kingdom, many readers are now enjoying, and the famous author and historian Dr. Will Durant, whose latest book, Caesar and Christ, is being widely read and discussed. Now, we're going to begin this evening with a question from Walter E. Owen of New York City. He wants you to get 2 out of 3 on this. And he asks you, what advice follows these words? The first is, since there's no help. Mr. Morley.
Then let us kiss and part.
Yes. Very good, Mr. Morley. You're quoting from whom?
One of the Caroline poets.
Drayton.
Drayton?
To be exact.
Michael Drayton.
Michael Drayton, as Mr. Adams reminds us. Mr. Adams, there's a very slight error in Mr. Morley's answer, not an important one. Say it again, Mr. Morley. Since there's no help, how does it go?
Then let us kiss.
I think it's Mr. Kieran.
Come,
let us kiss and part.
Oh, I always said then.
Well, it's all right. It may be better than Mr. Drayton's original. I don't know. Now, what advice follows this phrase? Yes, my darling daughter. Yes, my darling daughter. Mr. Adams?
Hang your clothes on a hickory limb and don't go near the water.
That's right. And you're quoting from what Caroline poet, Mr. Adams? M. Goose, I guess.
Mother, may I go out to swim? M.W. Goose.
M.W. Goose. Very good. Now, how about, here's the third and final phrase, followed by what advice? On the 18th of April in 28, my Tim began to decorporate. Mr. Adams.
I'm the author of that ditty.
Thank you, Mr. Adams. Now, will you help us out with the remainder of it? Well, it's about time.
That was the year I gave him his baseball suit.
Who?
Tim.
Who is Tim?
Tim is my boy now at Deerfield Academy, and I hope he's in bed.
And, Mr. Adams, when you wrote the first 2 lines of that poem, with what advice did you follow them? On the 18th of April in 28, my Tim began to decorporate. Then what did you say to Tim? Well, you've forgotten your own advice, Frank.
I don't remember. I gave him a baseball suit that year.
And that's the only thing you remember. Now,
how did it go?
Hardly a man is now alive, is what he was thinking of.
Well, it goes on. Be brave, my son, and speak the truth. And I hope you like your baseball suit. I'll tell you what, Adams, if Tim has got as bad a memory as you have for this advice, he is in pretty bad shape today. Well, we did get 3 out of 3 on that. Try this one, gentlemen, for Mrs. Ford Robinette of Phoenix, Arizona. With whom do you associate the following bathing habits? People bathe in different ways. After spending some time in a hot air room, the bather retires to a tepid room where he's rubbed clean with a scraper of metal or ivory and oiled. Mr. Kieran.
Well, that would be a Roman or a Greek athlete of the old days, I should say.
I should think. Which would you think, Dr. Durant, Roman or Greek?
Either one,
perhaps.
Scraper was called a strigil, wasn't it, Will?
So. Do you remember, Dr. Durant, what they called it?
Strigil.
I remember that the hot air room was called a calidorium.
No,
Calderium.
What was it called?
Calderium.
Calderium?
Calderium.
And what was the...
How I in it? C-A-L-D, Calderium.
I'll take Calderium. What was the tepid room called, Mr. Morley?
Tepidarium.
Correct.
Very good.
The bather... There's another case of an odd bathing habit. The bather mounts a wooden terrace in a room filled with hot air. He is soaked and rinsed on each step and smacked soundly with laurel and birch twigs. Very attractive. Dr. Durant,
I don't know anything about laurel and birch twigs. That's a new one to me.
You see. Mr. Kieran?
Well, I know they used laurel and birch twigs on the athletes of old, but it wasn't that I know in the bathing room. It was out on the field.
No, this is used in Russian and Finnish Turkish baths. Russian and Finnish baths, rather. I don't know what they use the twigs for, except perhaps to whip up their circulation.
That's the flagellarium.
That's Finnish flagellarium. We got one wrong on that. We have to get the next one right. Now, after being undressed, the bather lies prone in warm water while he's soaped and rinsed. He's wrapped up from head to foot, unwrapped, and then rubbed with oil.
That was the usual Greek and Roman custom, wasn't it? Though it may have occurred in other countries, too.
I think not. Lying prone in warm water, yes. Soaked and rinsed, wrapped from head to foot, unwrapped and rubbed with oil. Mr. Morley?
Either a sardine or the Egyptians.
You're splitting hairs there. You better make up your mind. Either a sardine or an Egyptian. No. Every mother who is listening to us will know the answer is babies. After being undressed, the bather lies prone in warm water. Mr. Adams, and you, the father of so many lovely and healthy children.
I never bathed those kids.
Now, of course, Sardine may be right, Mr. Morley, but I think babies is really the answer. That gives us two wrong out of three. Heinz 57 sends $57 in more bonds and stamps to Mrs. Robinette. Very good question, Mrs. Robinette, and a set of the Britannica. Mr. Adams, do you know how to bathe a baby now?
Nope.
Well, you don't have to worry. Mrs. A.J. Osborne. This is A.J. Osborne of Los Angeles, California. Send this one in. What did these words originally mean? Let's get all of them. Anthology. Originally meant what? Dr. Durant.
The word anthos, I think, meant a leaf. Didn't it? Anthology was a garland of leaves, of flowers.
Well, the anthos does mean flower. What's the last part of the...
Logos means literally the study of or might be a collection of. Anthology would be, therefore, a collection of flowers.
Yes, I think it comes from a Greek word, legain. My Greek is...
Choose.
Very poor. To gather. To gather or collect. Mr. Kieran, were you going to help us out on that?
Not a bit.
Anthology, therefore, is a... To gather flowers, a collection of flowers. Encyclopedia originally meant what? Encyclopedia. Mr. Morley.
Something that goes all round and helps the children.
Something that goes all round and helps the children.
Yes.
A merry-go-round.
Very good.
Will will check me on
is
that.
Is it permitted to praise one of the other gentlemen here?
Well, it isn't generally done, but we'll make an exception in your case, Dr. Durant.
I think that was very good. That's
rather crude, but it's literal.
It is quite literally true. From the Greek in, Mr. Kieran will help us out. Give us the Greek on
that. Kuklos, a circle, and paideia, a child.
That's yes, right. Paideia, also
means child. Paideos, a child.
Good enough.
Yeah. Paideia, the lore of children.
Well put, Mr. Morley. And now, almanac, gentlemen. Can you give us the original meaning of almanac? A common word, Mr. Morley?
It's an Arabic word. It means at the year or something like
you
that.
You know Arabic, too, Mr. Morley? No idea your learning extended that far.
I know the 10 digits.
It is from the Arabic. Al, the, plus monach, meaning what, would you say?
I think it means the year, doesn't it?
No, one would think that. Climate or weather. The climate or weather. We have a number of other words beginning with A-L that come from the Arabic.
We have the word, the name of the star, Aldebaran. That used to be two words that's run together.
Yes. Dr. Durant?
Of course you have algebra.
Algebra. Alcazar, the famous castle. Altoona, Pennsylvania. Any of those places are all.
Well, you know me.
Pardon?
You know me, Al.
Me, Al. Let's see. We were supposed to get all on that, though, and we did. We got only 2 out of 3. That's Heinz, 57 cents, $57, to Mrs. Osborne, and a set of the Britannica. How about this one from Dr. H.A. Finch of Philadelphia? You get 2 out of 3, and it's a musical question, gentlemen. What school of philosophic thought is suggested by these musical excerpts? They should bring to your mind, the mood of them should bring to your mind some school of philosophy or thinking. Let's have the first. Dr. Durant?
I'm afraid that's an Epicurean.
That's quite right. And why would you say that, Dr. Durant?
Well, we won't get home till morning indicates we're having a good time, which I suppose is a principle of the Epicurean philosophy.
That's, you put it very attractively. That's a good Dale Carnegie sell of the of Epicureanism. Of course, Epicureanism really was a somewhat more serious affair, wasn't it?
I'd call it the noctambulist philosophy.
The noctambulist philosophy? Night walking?
Yeah.
Well, he's a jolly good fellow.
We won't go home till morning.
We won't go home till morning. That's true. It's a new school.
Oh, no.
A new school, noctambulism. Now the second, Mr. Cohen. I have only one hand, the eminent philosopher, Dr. Durant.
Well, I presume that that theme is supposed to indicate fate, isn't it? And
keep going.
That would naturally be the Stoic philosophy.
Yes, or any fatalist.
Any fatalistic philosophy.
Yes.
But among the classic forms, of course, that is outside of India, it would be the Stoic philosophy.
Yes.
In India, it would be almost any philosophy.
Are they all fatalists in
practically,
India?
Practically,
I should say. What was Mr. Kahn playing, by the way, Dr. Durant? The phrase was from what composition?
The Fifth Symphony.
Yes, the Symphony of Beethoven. Quite right. And now the third and last. Blank look on these four philosophic faces. Mr. Adams, does that melody recall anything to you?
Paganism.
Pardon? Mr. Morley?
I don't know the tune.
Mr. Kieran?
No, it'd be nice if I knew what the tune was.
Well, I'll tell you the title of the song, and then you can give me the school of philosophic thought connected with it. Is You Is or Is You Ain't My Baby? Now, Mr. Morley?
Bimetallism.
Think of another? Mr. Kieran?
Biology.
Hedonism.
Whatever connected with doubt.
Yes, which is what, Mr. Adams?
Skepticism.
Yes, skepticism, as Mr. Morley reminds us. Well, we did get 2 out of 3 on that. Now, here's a question for our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer. Can you tell us, Ben, the meaning of this phrase, from eggs to apples?
Why, it means the same thing as our popular expression, from soup to nuts, a complete meal. It's an old Roman saying, so apparently their dinners must have started with eggs, just as ours start with soup. Well, I think the Romans missed something. Dinner begun with a soup, like Heinz condensed cream of tomato, always is off to a glowing start. It's festive to look at, bright and rosy, just like the satin-skinned tomatoes it's made from. And it steams with a wonderful, spice-laden aroma. But even better than the look and aroma of Heinz cream of tomato soup is its fresh-from-the-garden flavor, a rich, creamy goodness that tastes really homemade. And that's because Heinz condensed cream of tomato soup is made to an old home recipe in small batches, so the seasoning and blending of each one is personally tended by a master cook. It's condensed, you know. You just add an equal quantity of milk or water and heat. Ask for it specially. Heinz cream of tomato soup.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. Now, gentlemen, let's continue with this question from Morton D. Dunham of Armada, Michigan, and get 2 out of 3. What poet wrote a line which begins or ends with this phrase? The first is, hail to thee. Hail to thee. Mr. Adams?
Blithe spirit, bird thou never wert.
That's perfectly correct. And you're quoting Mr. Adams from what poem?
To a nightingale.
You got the wrong bird. Dr. Durant.
To a skylark.
To a skylark, yes. You do know the difference between a skylark and a nightingale, yes, Mr. Adams.
P.B. Shelley.
By Shelley. Now, we got another hail. What poet wrote a line which begins or ends with the phrase, hail and farewell? Hail and farewell, Dr. Durant.
Well, the original form, I think, was a poem by Catullus, the Latin poet, Ave Atque Vale.
That's the one I was thinking of, yes.
Is that the one you were thinking of?
Do you have any other in mind?
I believe there have been some modern variations on that, haven't there?
Of course, George Moore wrote volumes called Hail and Farewell. Yes, Catullus's famous poem on the burial of his brother.
I might add, if you'll allow me, that it is almost the most beautiful poem in the Latin language.
I hope that, your recommendation will send many people to it, Dr. Durant, particularly those who know Latin. Now the phrase, all hail, begins what line, Mr. Kieran?
All hail Macbeth, Thane of Cawdor.
Yes, who says the lines?
One of the witches.
Which one?
Well, first witch, I guess. I don't know.
First witch is right. Yes, she's addressing whom?
Macbeth.
She's addressing Macbeth in the one of the
early
scenes.
That name by W. Shakespeare.
That's the fellow. That gives us three hails out of three.
Will Shakespeare.
And were you named after Shakespeare, Mr. Dustin?
Yes, sir. And after William James.
Is that so?
That's pure accident.
Fine genealogy. James J. Daly of Newtonville, Massachusetts, sends this one in. Name a real or imaginary character of the ancient world who is remembered for the same thing as these moderns are remembered for. The first modern man is Maginot. Now, somebody in the ancient world did the same thing that Maginot did and is remembered for doing the same achievement, as it were. Mr. Morley.
Well, I don't know who built the Great Wall of China, but that was a line of fortification.
Agreed, but I think it would have to be a single person. I won't count that wrong, Mr. Morley, because... Mr. Adams?
Caesar.
Caesar, what makes you say Caesar?
Because I think Mr. Durant should know that.
Well, I'm going to toss that into Dr. Durant's lap.
I think it was the Chinese Emperor Shi Hongti, wasn't it?
Are you asking me, Dr. Durant?
Yes, you're supposed to know a few things.
Well,
too.
Mr. Morley is our Chinese expert.
I think Mr. Adams is right, Caesar, and the Roman wall across the north of Britain, between Britain and the wild Scots.
Well, there was one particular Roman emperor who did build a wall, Mr. Kieran.
Hadrian. I object.
Mr. Kieran.
I don't think Caesar built a wall between England and the wild Scots.
No, it was Hadrian, you're quite right.
Hadrian is the fellow I was thinking of, Mr. Morley. Hadrian's famous wall. Armed fortresses they were at which the legions and auxiliary troops were kept. I think on the whole, all those answers are right. I'd like to get the name of that Chinese fellow again, Dr. Durant.
I think he's Shi Huang T. Shihuang-Ti.
You accept that?
I believe the wall was built around 200 B.C., so it would come under the phrase antiquity.
It certainly would. How about Henry J. Kaiser? Now, there was somebody in the ancient world who did something of the same sort as Mr. Kaiser has been recently doing. Mr. Kieran.
There was one of the leaders in Athens.
You're right, Mr. Kieran.
Who
which one?
Said, put your trust in the wooden walls, or he followed that advice and built a fleet.
Very good.
And by that, using sea strategy, he defeated the enemies of the Athenians.
That's perfect. All we need is his name now. Mr. Morley will provide it.
Themistocles?
Themistocles, as Mr. Kieran said. Quite right.
I think it was a face that did better than, was nearer than... Kaiser, the face that launched 1,000 ships.
Helen, the Kaiser of her day, possibly. Stella Walsh has a corresponding character, Mr. Kieran.
Atalanta.
Who is Stella Walsh and who is Atalanta?
Stella Walsh was a woman athlete who is still around, and I think she's married now. I'm not sure about that. I don't want to spread any news. I don't want to see about it. Anyhow, she won a sprint championship at the Olympic Games, and Atalanta, of course, was the famous old Greek sprinter, young lady.
Was she married?
No, she had an unfortunate love affair, but finally was married to Hippomenes.
Things he knows. Yes, that gives us three out of three, gentlemen, and passes us on to this one from Harold L. Alda of New York City. Get two out of three. I think it's a very interesting question. Give the first names of these famous teams of fiction. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, their first names. Now, one of you has to give both names. Mr. Morley.
I didn't hear that both quite fast enough, but it was Dr. Henry Jekyll.
Keep going. That's correct, Mr. Morley. And Mr. Hyde had a first name.
Well, there was another very low fellow, Edward Hyde, the Earl of Clarendon, but
say no more. His name was Edward Hyde, and that's quite right. We just forget all about the Earl of Clarendon. Henry Jekyll and Edward Hyde. I don't suppose very many of us would remember the first names of that famous pair. Mr. and Mrs. Charles form a famous pair in modern fiction. Their first names, gentlemen. Mr. and Mrs. Charles. Mr. Adams, have you heard of Mr. and Mrs. Charles?
No.
Oh, shame. Dr. Durant, Mr. Q.
I know many Charles, but not Mr. and Mrs.
I hope that some of you have read, I'm sure, Chris, you've read The Thin Man by Dashiell Hammett, certainly one of the great detective stories of our time.
Yes, sir.
And the married pair there, are Nick and Nora Charles. You can also meet them in the movies, Mr. Adams, anytime you care to go. That gives us one wrong. Dr. and Mrs. Primrose, a famous pair of English fiction. They had first names. What were they? Dr. and Mrs. Primrose.
Well, they came in Goldsmith.
They came in Goldsmith. Goldsmith's what? What book?
The one where the greenhorn is taken in by buying the spectacles.
That's right. The Chagrin Spectacle Case.
The
Vicar of Wakefield. Now, what are their names?
Well, they always went to bed in the blue room.
That hardly gives us their names. Their names...
Well, the Reverend and Mrs.
Well, you might get away with that, Chris. Charles and Deborah Primrose. I don't suppose their names are mentioned more than two or three times. We got two wrong out of three. Heinz 57 sends $57 to Mr. Alder and a set of the Britannica. Now, gentlemen, try this one from Catherine R. McAleer of Lowell, Massachusetts. Again, get two out of three. This is about haircuts, special styles of haircuts. What people or group, name the people or group, whose style of haircut indicates that they were conquered? Best time, Mr. Kieran.
Well, the ones who are in modern France, the collaborators who are conquered by the Marquis have their hair cut off.
I hadn't thought of that. That's very good, Mr. Kieran. A larger group, though. And Dr. Durant?
Doesn't it refer to the Chinese after being conquered by the Manchus?
Yes, I should think so. They imposed what style of headdress? The Manchus imposed what style of headdress?
They compelled the Chinese to wear pigtails.
Yes, and the Chinese, being a very wise people, made
a virtue
out of it. Yes, quite so.
They got all knotted up in their own virtues.
How about a people whose style of haircut indicates that they defied their enemies? Their hairdress is a kind of challenge to their enemies, as it were. Mr. Morley.
The American?
Hey, head out, Mr. Morley.
Well, they put feathers in it to frighten and terrify the enemy.
Well, more than the feathers, the what was the style of headdress that the Indians wore?
Top knots.
Yes, scalp locks. Why, Mr. Kieran?
Well, I thought scalp locks.
Yes, it was a challenge to their enemies because it was easier to scalp them if they had a scalp lock than not. How about a people or group whose style of haircut is identified with a specific sport? Special kind of sport. Mr. Adams.
Baseball players.
How do you make that out?
Well, there's something that is still known as a baseball haircut, which is shaved around to the neck.
I didn't know that. Is that right, Mr. Kieran?
Well, that may be, but what is the popular one is the crew cut.
Yes, I imagine that Mr. Adams means the crew cut.
No. The baseball cut and the crew cut are very far apart socially.
Yes, and crew cut you'd see chiefly in what group of people?
In the college boys.
In the college boys, quite right. Well, that gives us three out of three. Now, here's our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer.
Mr. Fadiman, did you ever hear of tomato soup cake?
No, and I don't think I want to.
Now, just wait a minute. It sounds strange, and I haven't the slightest notion where the idea got started, but it certainly is a wonderful spice cake. You see, you put cinnamon in it, and nutmeg, and cloves, and a handful of chewy, nectar-filled, sun-made raisins, and tomato soup. And not just any tomato soup, ah, no. If you want to make that cake to perfection, you use Heinz new condensed cream of tomato soup. The thick, rich cream and the luscious puree of Heinz's own vine-ripened tomatoes give a special kind of flavor, a creamy color, a marvelous velvety texture. That cake just melts in your mouth, and it stays fresh for days. You can get the recipe right around the corner at your grocer's. You'll find it in a new booklet published by the Heinz Company. It's called 57 Ways to Use Soup. Now, that little book is full of whopping good ideas, 57 of them. 57 ways to use soup. Ask for it at your grocer's, and ask for Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup, too. The one and only, made from Heinz Aristocrat tomatoes and rich, thick cream.
Thank you, Mr. Grauer. Now, gentlemen, try this one from S. Holt Macaloney of Suffern, New York, and get two out of three. In what famous literary work will you find a talking horse? A talking horse. Where would you find one in a famous book? Dr. Durant?
In The golden ass, you refer to that, Apuleius?
I think that there is a distinction between a
horse an ass and a horse, huh?
Yes, I think so.
I'm afraid you're right.
Either your horse or the ass will tell you that. Mr. Morley?
Wasn't there an ancient Greek talking horse called Bucephalus? I don't know whether he spoke. Did he, Mr. Kieran?
Not that I know.
Not that we know of, no.
I never heard him.
Mr. Adams?
I think Jerome Wideman wrote a book by that name, didn't he?
He did write a book with
a horse that talked.
But I don't know whether there was an actual horse in that story, Mr. Adams. Mr. Kieran?
Well, I was just going to say, Bucephalus was the horse of that Alexander the Great.
Yes, I don't think he said a word.
No, not a word.
Mr. Amore.
There was a delightful old story for children called At the Back of the North Wind. A horse called Diamond in it. I think Diamond had something to say.
You got me there. I don't see why you're all...
Wasn't Bellerophon, was it?
I'm missing you're all missing the obvious answer, which is in Gulliver's Travels, the Houyhnhnms, and the last one of Gulliver.
We missed a whole flock of horses.
You certainly did. Now, Dr. Ryan, I'm going to give you a chance to tell... Pardon me, tell us where you find a talking donkey.
In the golden ass of Apuleius.
Of Apuleius, yes. Work of Latinity. Also, I think there is one in Pinocchio, isn't there? Or am I mistaken? Is there not a donkey? The little boys are changed into donkeys?
There's
donkey
one in the Bible, Balaam.
Yeah, there is one. Now, where would you find a talking cat in some work of fiction? Mr. Morley?
Dick Whittington and his famous cat.
That's right. You would find one there, Mr. Kieran.
It's a talking cat in a modern a story by an English modern writer.
Quite right.
I can't think of his
name.
Saki. Saki, that's
the name of the cat.
It's a wonderful story.
Wonderful story, and the name of the cat is Tobermory. That gives us 2 out of 3, and that's all we have time for. Thank you, Dr. Durand, and thank you, Mr. Morley, for your wit and wisdom this evening. Tonight, Heinz 57 has paid out $171 in war bonds and stamps and 3 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams will be on hand to greet their 2 guests, Miss Emily Kimbrough and Miss Diana Lynn. We look forward with special interest to Miss Lynn's appearance, for she is the youngest guest who has ever graced this program, being hardly 18. She plays the part of Miss Kimbrough in the motion picture version of Our Hearts Were Young and Gay. And since that bestseller, by the way, Miss Kimbrough has written another book, How Dear to My Heart, shortly to be published. Remember, send your questions and the correct answers to Information, Please, at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. And our Heinz reporter, Ben Brower, who has a word about a tasty food, and then we'll give you the news headlines of the moment.
Here's something of real and immediate interest to those of you who love fine eating. All Heinz delicious soups are now condensed. Simply add a can of water to a can of soup, or to cream soups, add milk if you prefer, then heat and enjoy some of the world's best soup. These new condensed Heinz soups have the same rich, home-like zest, the same delicious Heinz-made flavor. They are super strength, super value. You'll like them better than ever. And here are the latest headlines from the NBC newsroom. More good news from the Pacific tonight. American carrier planes attacking the waters off Luzon Island in the Philippines have sunk 1 Jap sub-chaser, probably sunk another cruiser, and damaged 4 other Jap warships and a number of cargo vessels. On Leyte, General MacArthur's men have made another 4-mile advance toward Ormoc. And now, until next Monday night at the same time, H.J. Heinz Company wishes you good health and good evening.